Back together again, you and I chatting it up Monday style, June the 29th, 2026, right here on Connecticut Today. Big rulings from the U.S. Supreme Court. We dissected those, and I got also some perspective from Professor John Martin, Quinnipiac University Law School, and our buddy, our pal Mike O'Neill, Landmark Legal Foundation VP for Legal Affairs. They all chimed in regarding a key decision handed down by the High Court. Columnist and blogger Terry Cowgill also dropped by to discuss tax ideas and those data centers.
Well, as I like to mention, and Mr. Dylan likes to sing from time to time, all the times, yes. Well, they are a-changing, and we get another one of that today, and maybe Election Day doesn't mean Election Day anymore. How are you? 203-333-9422-333-WICC. We start with this, and we set this up as our question of the day, and folks are, you know, already jumping on this, so no surprise here, but a big ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court, and that will have definite impact here in Connecticut, because remember, pretty soon, sooner than later, although I don't think it's going to be set for this November, but sooner than later, we're going to that no-excuse absentee ballot situation, which is essentially mail-in voting, and essentially Connecticut could be affected by this. The U.S. Supreme Court says mail-in ballots are good as long as they are postmarked by Election Day. The court, earlier today, not a 6-3 ruling, a mixed ruling, a 5-4 opinion on that. And Justice Amy Coney Barrett wrote the majority opinion. So without her, it's 4-4. Actually, without any of the conservatives, you know, it's 4-4. And it ended up being a 5-4 ruling. The Supreme Court on Monday ruled in favor of a Mississippi law. Now, this is not from what you would call a blue state here. But they ruled in favor of a Mississippi law allowing mail-in ballots to be counted in elections even if they're received after Election Day. How about that? The court split on the ruling. As we mentioned, Justice Amy Coney Barrett led the majority opinion on a 5-4 ruling. She was joined. Now, you talk about a mixed ruling here. Amy Coney Barrett, in the majority opinion, joined by Chief Justice John Roberts, as well as Justices Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, and Ketanji Brown Jackson. So the three women that make up the liberal wing of the court on most things were joined by Amy Coney Barrett and Chief Justice John Roberts. Well, how about that? Barrett's opinion held that Election Day in the context of law set a deadline for when voters must make a choice regarding their preferred candidate. Doesn't mean the ballot has to be received, but this is about making a choice. Relevant laws, however, they reason, impose no standard for when ballots must be received to be considered valid. Justice Samuel Alito wrote in the dissent, he took a different view of what it means for the electorate to have made a choice. He wrote in part, quote, if ballots received after Election Day are added to the set of ballots that dictate the election's outcome, the electorate's choice does not occur on Election Day. How about that thinking? He adds, quote, the acceptance of these late-arriving ballots effectively postpones the date on which the electorate's choice is made. If the Supreme Court had ruled the ballots received after Election Day were invalid, which is what a lot of people were hoping here, 14 states, 3 U.S. territories, and Washington, D.C. would have all been forced to change their laws ahead of the upcoming election day this coming November. So we're just a few months out there. So what are your thoughts on this? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. So you have the majority in the court here saying, well, the idea of making a choice and when the election is actually valid is different from when the ballots are received. So in other words, the majority here is saying, well, you know, you make a choice that should not be hampered by the time it takes or an artificial deadline of when the ballots have to be in. I know it sounds weird, and this is one of those decisions that makes for strange bedfellows, don't you think? So what are your thoughts on this? Our question of the day right here. The U.S. Supreme Court says that states can receive mail-in ballots after Election Day. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. All right, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. U.S. Supreme Court says that states can count mail-in ballots arriving after Election Day, but postmarked on time. I got to correct that. I put in time. In time, on time, whatever. What are your thoughts? 203-333-9422-333-WICC. SCOTUS is saying as long as the mail-in ballots arrive after Election Day, they're okay if they were postmarked beforehand. Was a close decision, though, 5-4. The court divided 5-4, holding that a Mississippi law challenged by the Republican National Committee, the RNC, does not unlawfully conflict with federal law that sets Election Day in early November. And the notion here is what day is Election Day, they say theoretically, and when do people actually make that choice? 5-4 ruling here. You know what? I can live with that. I can. I know it sounds a little weird here, but you go by the postmark, don't you? Isn't that what we want to do here? Isn't that why a lot of us, me, who sometimes waits until April 14th or April 15th to, you know, do our taxes here, we sit there and we make sure we say to the fine Postal Service employee, hey, can you just make sure you postmark that because I want to see it. So the court held that a Mississippi law that was challenged by the RNC does not unlawfully conflict with federal law. The ruling was authored by Justice Amy Coney Barrett. Now, the Trump White House says here, this is the NBC News version, frequently criticized mail-in voting, claiming without offering evidence that it's full of fraud. That move avoids an election year upheaval of state election laws. The Mississippi law and 13 other states will remain in effect for this year's November midterms. So the high court saying, although it was 5-4, saying, well, if you postmark it by Election Day, it's okay. We'll give it a few days here. What are your thoughts here? How are you reckoning with this one? 203-333-9422-333-WICC. Chris in Norwalk leads us off today. Hey, Chris, good afternoon. How are you?
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, Chris.
I was listening this morning, and I was trying to understand that I believe that it's Mississippi, right?
Yeah,
it was
a Mississippi law. Yes, sir.
Right. So their law, if I understood it correctly after watching C-SPAN this morning,
yeah,
that the law says that it could be postmarked up to 5 days after Election Day, not just Election Day, and then they have to count it within 5 days. So I don't know how accurate your description of it is. I'm not saying I'm right. I'm just saying maybe we need to look look at it a little closer. And
well, apparently,
either way, it's awful.
Yeah. Oh, you know. So you don't like the you don't like this, that as long as it's postmarked by Election Day, we'll give it a couple of days cushion here. You don't like that?
No. The Election Day is Election Day. It should arrive. In the Civil War, even the South was able to get their soldiers to get the vote in by Election Day. So, you know, if they could stop a war when there wasn't electronic capabilities, I think that, you know, we can handle, you know, the first Tuesday in November.
Says here, Chris, the decision, this is the NBC News version here. It says this avoids an election year upheaval of state election laws, that Mississippi law and similar measures in 13 states will remain in effect ahead of the midterms. The laws in question, it says here, Chris, allow late arriving ballots to be counted as long as they were mailed by the Election Day deadline. So there's even more confusion there.
Right. The Election Day deadline may be different in each state, whichever the, you know, they get to make it up.
Yeah.
So, you know, look what happened in California.
Yeah.
Right?
Now, California, you know, says, hey, we take our time with it. That's why we took 5 or 6 days, because we do most of this by hand. You're not buying that, though, or are you?
No, because it took longer than 5 or 6 days. It took a couple of weeks. And I remember in the 2024 election.
Yeah.
It was months before the final tally was provided and certified by the state of California.
Yeah.
So it allows for fraud to occur.
All right, Chris, thank you. I appreciate the call, my friend. Good to hear you. Chris there in Norwalk, obviously in some sort of vehicle. And we encourage you to call us hands-free, please. Keep two hands on the rudder or the wheel. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. And you wonder if the Supreme Court said, nah, let's just let this stay. Because if we had to change this now, and then everybody would have been going crazy with these 13 or 14 other states. The High Court divided 5-4, which is interesting on who said to basically keep it the way it is. The three liberals on the court, Ketanji Brown Jackson, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan, along with a couple of conservatives there. And the four remaining naysayers were part of the conservative wing. The laws in question, in other words, 13 or 14 states have these laws, allow late arriving ballots to be counted as long as they were mailed by the Election Day deadline. California, New York, and Texas are among the states with such laws. So it's not all blue here. There are red laws as well. Justice Alito saying that the move could threaten election integrity and increase the risks of fraud. He said that the majority based its move on a flawed understanding of Election Day statutes. So even the men and women on the court disagree and point fingers at each other. How about that? Alito said, quote, Election Day is a specific date, not a span of multiple days, which I think a lot of people may agree with. All righty, traffic and weather together coming up right here, WICC. We talk to our next guest and first of the day. We've had him on before, Professor John Martin, Quinnipiac University Law School, talking about what the court did and didn't say today on some big cases. Hey, John, it's Paul again. How are you, sir?
Hey, Paul, how are you? Thanks for having me on.
I'm all right, man. Interesting day. So, John, you tell me, according to what the court said today, with a very strange split of bedfellows, 5-4,
yes.
When exactly is Election Day, John? Explain it to me, please, because now I'm confused.
First of all, you're right. It's an interesting majority. We have three liberal justices siding with Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who authored the opinion.
Yeah.
Federal law says that federal elections need to be held on the Tuesday after the first Monday in November. I think a lot of us, you know, who go out and vote are aware of this. For congressional elections, it's every 2 years. For presidential elections, every 4 years. But in 30 states, at least, mail-in ballots or absentee ballots are often counted within a certain range of time after Election Day in the state. In this case, it was Mississippi. It was up to 5 days after Election Day. So long as the mailed-in ballot was postmarked by Election Day. Mm-hmm. Now, the plaintiff here, the Republican National Committee, argued, hold on, if you're counting the ballot after Election Day, you're going against federal law, because the election has to be on that Tuesday after that first Monday in November. You're counting these ballots on the Thursday, right?
Yeah.
And so you're extending the election past when it's supposed to be. Now, that argument ultimately, so the question of the case was, what is an election, right? That's really what it comes down to. What's the definition of election? From that argument, you would define election as not just the casting of the ballot, but the counting of the ballot, right? Yeah. The whole process. The other argument is that an election is simply the act of choosing a person to fill an office. So once I fill out my ballot and send it in, I've elected someone. That's part of the election. And that's the argument that ultimately won the day here in the 5-justice majority. The fact that an election is simply choosing a person. Once I submit my ballot, so long as it's postmarked by the election day, it's up to the state to decide how long they want to stretch out their process for counting that ballot.
This, John Martin, is really an interesting case because you've got reasoning on both sides of the aisle. I'm sorry, on both sides of the decision here, the majority and the minority decision. To me, you could read it and say, you could read Justice Barrett's position here and say, all right, I kind of agree with that. That makes sense. But then you could read the dissent and say, wait a minute, that kind of makes sense, too. I mean, that's why I wanted to have you on, because this is just a really, not a weird case, but a case that really does rest on a razor's edge or a fine line, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's one of those cases that exemplifies why the Supreme Court's focus on the plain text of the language as well as history can sometimes be less straightforward than I think proponents of those interpretive theories would like to argue.
Yeah.
Because you could look from the dissent's perspective, and it's, let's be clear, it's an originalist court these days.
Yeah.
We have history at various times in our country where ballots weren't accepted if they weren't received by Election Day, notably during the Civil War. Yep. This wasn't allowed. But then you could also argue that, as the majority points out, but there were other times where it was, such as during World War II, and then now, right? Nowadays, we allow under federal law when our uniformed men and women overseas submit their ballots, we allow states to count them, right, after Election Day, as long as they're postmarked by Election Day. So as far as the historical argument, it's kind of, you could go either way with it. That's why the majority seems to throw up their hands and say, we're just going to look at the text, right? We're going to look at the word election. We're going to look at what did dictionaries say back in the day about the definition of election. And they arrive at the simple definition of the act of choosing a person to fill an office. In their mind, it's that straightforward. I'm sure you could find other, this is a problem with textualism too, is you could find other dictionary definitions out there that support your own argument. But that's the definition that won at the end of the day here.
Quinnipiac University Law School Professor John Martin. John, finally, the other rulings today have to do with what the president, Mr. Trump, or anybody else can do as far as hiring and firing people. Do I understand that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And break that down for us briefly here. What do people need to know about that?
Well, look, the Constitution says that the executive authority is vested within the president, right? A person, not the executive branch, but the person, the president. And so that has led to a theory of unitary executive power, the idea that the president should be allowed to make any hiring or firing decisions for both principal officers, say the cabinet, or inferior officers, those working under the heads of agencies. And the Supreme Court kind of went both ways here when it came to the Federal Trade Commission. They went more on the side of, you know, the president should have this authority to hire, fire whoever is in charge of the FTC, right? It's an executive agency. The president should be allowed to command who's in charge. But with the Fed, we went the other way and said, no, the president has to show for cause. They have to show cause, right? Mm-hmm. That there's a good reason to fire a member of the Fed. I think the idea, if you want to come up with a policy justification, it's that we just view the Fed as the agency that necessitates even more independent authority than something like the FTC. We don't want the president really meddling with those who are essentially determining our entire nation's economic future, right?
John Martin, Quinnipiac University. John, good to have you on. Thanks, man. Appreciate it. We'll talk down the road, I am sure. Thank you, sir.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Paul.
All right. Professor John Martin, Quinnipiac Law School, on some of the big things today. So when exactly is Election Day? I know what you're going to say. Oh, come on, Paul. A trick question. We all know it's the first Tuesday after the first Monday here in the great state of Connecticut. And by the way, we're getting mail-in voting starting for this election cycle, I guess, right? I'm seeing it here on the new list of laws coming in. Well, then now, are we going to adopt a law like these 13 other states had that was upheld today, the Mississippi law? Will Connecticut follow suit here? I got to watch and see. I'm sure there were some Democratic leaders in Hartford high-fiving each other. Get the national perspective on this. Joining us right now, one of our great legal eagles, VP Legal Affairs at the Conservative Landmark Legal Foundation, the one and only Mike O'Neill. Mike, how are you, sir?
I'm great, Paul. How are you doing?
Not too bad, sir. So, I don't know. When I had to laugh here, Mike. What's an election mean? When does it start? When does it end?
Right.
And the grouping of the majority decision, I went, what, when I read that?
Right, right. So let's start out with the grouping. And then, well, let's start out with the findings here. So you had an opinion authored by Justice Barrett, so joined by Chief Justice Roberts, and then the liberal, quote-unquote liberal wing, Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson. And they upheld Mississippi's law that permits the receipt of mail ballots 5 days after Election Day.
Yeah.
So Justice Barrett concluded that election doesn't just mean casting your vote. It also means receiving your vote.
Uh-huh.
And so there's no conflict with Mississippi's law that permits the receipt of ballots 5 days post Election Day. So this is of course disappointing from my perspective. I think it's disappointing for an election security perspective. I also think, you know, oftentimes we talk about policy and everything, but it comes back to the text. What does the text of the law say?
Yeah.
And you're seeing this repeatedly in decisions from the Supreme Court this term. Again, you start with the text of the federal statute here, and I interpret election to mean two things, not only casting your ballot and receiving your ballot. So Election Day, that means ballots have to be received by the conclusion of Election Day.
Mm-hmm.
Justice Barrett, in this narrowly applicable situation, again, she was the majority opinion is very clear. It's only interpreting the legality of this Mississippi law.
Yeah.
That leads into question. Now, there's other laws that are even more permissible. For example, Washington State has 21 days allows it. No limiting principle here. This is problematic here, is that the court doesn't elicit or doesn't voice a limiting principle here. When is too long?
Too long.
I mean, you're talking election season with 21 days. How about another problem I'll proffer to you? California, you don't even need a postmark. Now, in the Mississippi law said they had to be postmarked by Election Day.
Yeah.
So now here we go. Are new challenges going to arise? And I think new challenges should arise. I think, obviously, oftentimes the court only deals with the issue as presented before, and it can only rule on the legality of this Mississippi law. It can't rule on the legality of the California law or the Washington law. Now, of course, if the court had concluded how I was hoping that they were going to conclude, that this Mississippi law, which of course is 5 days, and anything more, you know, that extends it past 5 days would be presumptively invalid as well, Washington or California. So I would expect, Paul, I would hope to see this challenges, you know, new challenges arising regarding the California law or the Washington law, see if those are consistent with federal law. But for right now, as you were saying, you guys law, it's unfortunate now you have a widespread use of mail voting. I generally think mail voting, and Justice Alito gets into this a lot in his dissent, which I would encourage you to read.
Yeah.
But mail voting, I think it's not controversial to say that it is inherently riskier. I'm not going to say, you know, I'm not going to go out there on the limb and say fraud and all this, but it is a riskier process, and it kind of undermines the importance of voting in the secret ballot. Remember, if you have a mail balloting, that means people oftentimes allows ballot harvesters to come to your door, knock on your door. So kind of undermines a lot of that sort of thing. So I like to see in person on election day.
Yeah.
Other states are ruling, unfortunately, are implementing mail ballots. But again, I would like reasonable requirements that the ballots be received by election day, but apparently the Supreme Court doesn't agree with me.
Yeah, and Mike, if you have about 4 days to do absolutely nothing, go online and Google Bridgeport, Connecticut, our home market, and absentee ballots. Just do me a favor. Your jaw will hit the floor.
Right.
Trust me.
Right.
Utah, Mike, I got to tell you, ballot harvesting is a food group around here.
Right.
We've got like 3 or 4 criminal cases going on here. So, I guess. And you know what it is, Mike? A lot of people, you know, just to wrap up on this, I want to get your thought on this.
Sure.
A lot of people say, well, all right, if it's a few ballots here and there, it's not going to. Yeah, but Mike, we once had a congressional district here in Connecticut decided by like 12 votes. 12.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
We have General Assembly votes, districts here decided by 100, 150 votes. Yeah,
absolutely. That there are plenty of cases of narrow election victories, and you're talking dozens or hundreds of votes. That even that being said, it doesn't take a lot of legwork to operate a ballot harvesting operation to manufacture thousands of votes. And again, look at here's an interesting one. Look at the Democrat nominations for some of these congressional districts around New York City.
Yeah.
We're talking only 70,000 people, or really low numbers when you're talking about primary votes. So it doesn't take a lot. It really doesn't take a lot of legwork to generate thousands of mail ballots if you engage in a sophisticated ballot harvesting operation. And let me be very clear.
Sure.
A lot of the left is really proficient in doing this. I mean, it's really not a coincidence that you see when mail ballots are prevalent, 80% of those times you have Democrats that emerge victorious. Because they have it down to a T, really down to a science, and how to descend upon vulnerable populations and collect ballots and collect votes that are in for their particular candidate.
Mike, so, I'm telling you, man, Bridgeport, Connecticut, ballot harvesting. Will you promise me that? Sometime in the next month, we'll do that, okay?
Sure.
All right.
Absolutely. And it's unfortunate your legislature isn't getting the message here. You know, I guess they want to protect themselves.
Well, what I've been told, Mike, on air and off, is that this is what has been alleged, I'm just saying what happens is anytime they get close to really passing a bill with teeth in it here, somebody wanders up to somebody who they know they can kind of muscle a little bit and say, hey, yeah, I know you're thinking about your vote on this bill. It'd be a shame if we didn't fund that new high school that you want too, right?
Right. Well, let me put a pitch in here for the Save America Act. Federal legislation can come in and set some baseline levels of securities for our voting. Now, again, the Save America Act doesn't have to do with mail voting, but it does help. It obligates state officials to clean up their voter rolls, identify and remove non-citizens, proof of citizenship when you register to vote, and even importantly, that 90% of Americans agree with, show identification when you show up to vote on election day mandate. That's a federal law that needs to kind of step into the breach when you see these states that are really deficient in their obligations to ensure free and integral and important federal all elections.
All right, Mike O'Neill, Landmark Legal Foundation. As always, Mikey, we appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
Take care, Paul. Have a great day.
Bye-bye. Our buddy, our pal Terry Cowgill stops by, our regular Monday guy, Substack.com. And the Connecticut News Junkie, Mr. Cowgill, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Not bad, thank you. And yes, there are Democratic Socialists in Connecticut. I have seen them on My Left Nutmeg, which is a Facebook page run by Danbury Democratic activist Alfonso Robinson.
Yep.
And the motto of the page is, this is where Connecticut Democrats scratch that progressive itch.
Yeah, I know that.
You've probably seen it.
A couple things you write about here, and I saw this. Is this a preview, Terry, of 2028? Gavin Newsom, here we go, pushing something that apparently Ned Lamont won't, a wealth tax. A wealth tax.
Right. And you might ask yourself, you know, why? Well, first of all, just so everybody knows, a wealth tax is a tax not on income, but on a it's a tax on your assets,
yeah,
and your net worth, right? And so we don't have one here in Connecticut. They don't even have one in California yet. And Gavin Newsom is officially against the one in California, but he's because I think he's afraid that a lot of people will flee California for other states.
You think?
So he's proposing a national wealth tax.
Ah.
And then that way, you know, you'd have to leave the country then, I guess, if you wanted to do that. But why is this relevant to Connecticut? Well, because I think, you know, we are an asset-rich state.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if we still are the richest state per capita in the nation. If we're not, we're right up there. We're close to it anyway.
Yeah.
And California is also a bellwether state, right? Because a lot of trends start there and mm-hmm. then spread eastward, such as you and I are old enough to remember a fellow named Howard Jarvis.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was the proponent of Proposition 13
yeah.
in 1978, which limited property tax increases in California. And it spread so far, in fact, that Massachusetts later enacted Proposition 2.5, which limited tax levy increases to 2.5% a year.
Yeah.
So you know, these are the kinds of things that can spread. And so, you know, I'm not a fan of wealth taxes, but just like you, do you own your own home, Paul?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I have a mortgage on it, yeah, but I'm a, I own, yeah, sure.
Okay, so you and I are both already paying wealth tax, believe it or not, and it's called the property tax.
That's right.
And the thing is, and some people might say, well, it's not a wealth tax, you know, it's just a house, but your house is an unrealized asset.
That's right.
So you're being taxed on it as an asset, even though you haven't sold it, just as you would be taxed on stocks that are sitting there and mm-hmm. have not been sold.
Mm-hmm.
And then in terms of the property tax, you're taxed again when you sell it. You're taxed on the profits. You pay a capital gains tax then. There's an exemption of I don't know how much it is. You don't pay the full property, the full capital gains tax on it. But nonetheless, you know, we already have wealth taxes in this country.
Yeah.
So it shouldn't be that controversial to just float that idea. But I'll tell you, man, it really, it puts a bee in a lot of people's bonnet. I'm sure you've heard from people.
Oh, yeah. Terry, you sound like a Republican. I just got to tell you, for that minute or so, you're on a MAGA roll there. I got to tell you. Well, another thing you're writing here I find interesting, and I'm glad you're writing this. Now, along with trillionaire, and don't get me started on that, with Elon Musk and all the anti-Semitism that's right out in front of the Democratic Party right now, this sudden hatred of data centers. But you're looking into this, and there are already a lot of these places around, you tell me.
Yeah, there are. And you know, the number in different states varies according to how receptive the states are
mm-hmm.
in accepting these data centers. You know, just so people know who haven't been paying attention to this, but, we all spend time on the internet and we want it to work properly.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very, very data intensive, and they have to have these giant computer centers, essentially, where all of these platforms are hosted. And now, with the advent of AI, we need even more of them, because the average Google search, if you just do a garden variety Google search
mm-hmm.
and then you do the same Google search only using Gemini, which is the AI chatbot on Google, the difference between a regular Google search and a Gemini Google search is it's 100%, it's more than 100% more. It's like 1,000% more electricity to use an AI search than to do a regular search. So we really need these things unless we just want to let AI stall in its development. But Connecticut has about anywhere between 17 and 59 data centers. It depends on how you do the counting and which source you look at.
Yeah.
But we don't have two things or three things really that you need in order to host a data center. One, you need lots of land.
Mm-hmm.
You need plenty of water.
Yeah.
We actually have that compared to a lot of other states. We have plenty of water. And you also need plenty of excess electricity.
Yeah.
And that we don't really have, although, you know, Ned Lamont has said, well, Millstone could ramp it up, and, you know, they could turn that thing up, that nuclear plant.
Yeah.
But I think that that's nonetheless, the added demand would raise electricity prices even higher than they are already. And we have, what, the third or fourth highest in the country?
Yeah, it wavers that Hawaii is far and away number one. And, you know, I'm kind of disappointed because I think we're second or third. Listen, Terry, if you're going to be in a contest, be number one. I don't like this second and third thing, you know?
Exactly.
As the great Dale Earnhardt used to say, the second place guy's the first loser. You know, come on. I don't need that. All right, folks.
But the thing is, nobody wants them in their
backyard. Well, exactly.
We all want our Facebook to work right, and we want our searches to do great. We want our Amazon page to come up. We want all this stuff, but we don't want the inconvenience attached to it. So keep your eyes on Loudoun County, Virginia, because that's a hot spot for data centers.
Yeah, I've read that. All right. Good stuff there. The wealth tax and data centers. Terry Cowgill, the Connecticut News Junkie, ctnewsjunkie.com, and also substack.com, red meat for mushy moderates. Terry, good to chat with you. Have a great week. We'll talk next time around. Thank you, sir.
All right, Paul. Thank you.
All right. There you go. Check it out. Terry Cowgill, great writer, does his national stuff on Substack and local Connecticut stuff on the Connecticut News Junkie, ctnewsjunkie.com.